Welcome to Changing Academic Life. I'm Geraldine Fitzpatrick, and this is a podcast series where academics and others share their stories, provide ideas, and provoke discussions about what we can do individually and collectively to change academic life for the better.
I think sometimes that becomes like you're just on autopilot and you're doing it. Like, I think I've been doing good work, but I was so focused on tenure and getting publications out and doing the next thing that I thought I needed to do that I had actually never stopped to ask myself if the things I was doing were what I actually really wanted to do. Like, is this what I'm passionate about? Yeah. Is this how I want my career to take shape?
I'm curious whether you recognize yourself in this or whether it was just me. I think we can all get caught up on autopilot and on the next thing. And we miss the opportunities, those really important opportunities, to pause and reflect and reset. I'm talking here with Bethany Wilinski. Bethany's an associate professor of teacher education at Michigan State University, and she's also a sabbatical coach. What Bethany was talking about in this clip was her wake-up moment when she was planning her own sabbatical. So in part one of this conversation, Bethany describes how she started off with the autopilot option, and then she recognized that she was actually really burned out and needed to make some very different choices. This led her to reframe her sabbatical as a time for restoration and connection. It's such a rich conversation, covering topics like shifting identity, setting boundaries, pausing before saying yes, focusing on finishing work, and unlearning academia's hidden curriculum of constant striving. And while the particular context for Bethany's story is post-tenure sabbatical, I think the insights that she shares can apply equally well to all career stages and to all types of leave, like also parental leave and so on. And this is whether you're a postdoc or post-tenure or getting into your later career stage, where you may also be starting to question the shape of the rest of your career. So I hope you enjoy part one here. We'll follow up in the next episode with part two, where Bethany will go on to share some practical tips and tricks about how you can be more intentional in designing your own sabbatical.
Bethany, thank you very much for joining me. And why I want to talk to you today is I know that you're really passionate about the idea of sabbaticals and that we approach sabbaticals with much more intention. And being intentional is a theme of this current season of the podcast. So it actually fits really nicely in that. Do you want to introduce yourself first?
Sure. My name is Bethany Wilinski, and I am an associate professor of teacher education at Michigan State University in the U.S. I've been in that role for actually almost 11 years exactly now. I started in January 2015, and I earned tenure in July 2022, and then I took a sabbatical for a year during the academic year of 2023-2024. Wow.
And it was that sabbatical experience that put you on this passion path. What happened?
Sure. I mean, so it actually started with the planning, which is why I focus on sabbatical planning in my coaching business. But what happened is by the time I got tenure, I was just completely burned out. You know, two young kids during the pandemic. I joke with my son that he's now 12. And I joke that he was a kindergarten dropout because the pandemic started when he was in kindergarten and school ended in March and we never went back. So, and then my daughter was just under two when the pandemic started. So we were very busy and very stressed. And then it felt like for people with young kids, it took, you know, multiple years, I think, kind of the rest of the world had gone back to normal and we were still dealing with school closures and daycare closures when anyone got COVID. So that was extremely stressful. And then we had a lot of loss in our family. My mom got diagnosed with a terminal illness and died, you know, not too long after. My mother-in-law unexpectedly passed away close to my mom. And so we were exhausted. I was exhausted. But I saw the sabbatical as like, it was a lot. It was a lot. But I'd always looked forward to my sabbatical. And so I saw it kind of there as a beacon, like, this is going to save me. This is going to help me, you know, get some time to get my feet under me and recharge. And I had always assumed that I would go away for my sabbatical because I do research in Tanzania. So I study early childhood education. I do work in the U.S., but I also do work in Tanzania. And so, you know, you can imagine I have to wedge those trips to Tanzania in around everything else, you know, teaching and with the kids. It's hard to get away for long.
You were still doing travel for the research.
Yes. Yeah. So I was traveling, I mean, with the pandemic, of course, I had like a 2-year break, but by the time I got tenure, I think I had started going back. But I thought, well, sabbatical would be such a great time to spend a year in Tanzania working on my research. And so I think I automatically, when my sabbatical was coming up, I was very excited about it. But I also very quickly started planning the sabbatical that was kind of the expected sabbatical, right? The one that would be professionally most meaningful.
So when you say expected, where did you get the notions from about what's expected?
My own head, for the way I've been socialized as an academic. I do, you know, my work is in the field of comparative education. And so I think there's something that's in the water, and I do ethnographic research. So being in country for an extended period of time is very important. And I think I had seen, you know, mentors, colleagues who went before me who used their sabbatical as time to have that extended period in the field.
Right.
So it was, and I wanted to.
Yeah. So a combination of both having seen other people do it and that it align nicely with your research approach and that being immersed in the culture.
Yeah. And I had spent, you know, the reason I do work in Tanzania is because when I my undergraduate degree was in elementary education. And so I taught, my first job out of college was actually teaching in Tanzania. So I had lived there for 2 years. I met my husband there. So it's a special place. And in my current role, I'm a regular faculty member, but I also work on we have a sustainable development project in Tanzania. So I'm very much engaged in Tanzania. So there was also a personal pull to being there and having the opportunity to live there again. My husband was excited. We were excited about, you know, bringing our children there to live for a little bit. So
that all sounds perfect.
What? Right. And I thought it was. I know. You're like, why would you not have taken that sabbatical? So the way I approached it, I applied for a Fulbright, which is a U.S. Department of State grant that allows you, you know, that would have funded me to go to Tanzania for a year. They're very competitive. And so I wrote what I think was a very compelling application. I proposed this, you know, the goal is really collaboration. And so I had proposed a new collaboration and it was a very, you know, huge involved project with new collaborators, not the ones I had worked with already, but I thought, well, this will be a nice way to, you know, meet new collaborators, but then I'll also obviously have time with the friends and colleagues I already have, you know. And so almost as soon as I think I clicked submit on that application, I thought, I don't know if this is actually the sabbatical that I need. I'm exhausted. I'm burned out. I have projects, so many projects in Tanzania, so much data that I have not already dealt with. And I'm not sure starting something new and big is actually going to serve me.
Can I probe on what you just said there, though? Because you said, as soon as you press submit, you thought. Was it a thought or did it start in your body somewhere? Do you know what I mean?
It probably started in my body. Yeah, probably an uneasiness. I think, as you know, I always tell my clients, you don't need more advice from me on how to be more productive, right? If you're at the point in your career where, at least in the US, if you've earned tenure, earned a sabbatical, you're pretty productive and highly motivated, right? But I think sometimes that becomes like you're just on autopilot and you're doing it. Like, maybe I think I've been doing good work, but I was so focused on tenure and getting publications out and doing the next thing that I thought I needed to do that I had actually never stopped to ask myself if the things I was doing were what I actually really wanted to do. Like, is this what I'm passionate about? Yeah. Is this how I want my career to take shape? Yeah. And so there must have been something that I paused, or I had a quiet moment, and this kind of feeling started creeping in. Like, I don't know if this is really what I want. And part of it, there was a logistical piece to this. So my husband was an academic at the time, and he's a scientist. So he was working in a lab. And so he really couldn't go to Tanzania for a full year. But the only grant available was for a full year. And so there was a tension, because I thought, well, I mean, in theory, I could be in Tanzania by myself, and he would have the kids in the U.S., or he would come back to the U.S. after a time and I would be in Tanzania with the kids. But as I played that out in my head, I thought, that's not what I want. I really like spending time with my husband. I don't want to be, you know, the being in Tanzania is not worth upsetting our family dynamic in that way. So I think it was a combination of like really wrapping my head maybe around the personal side of it, but then also this, yeah, I think like you said, this maybe a feeling that, I don't know, I really need to slow down. I need a break. I don't need this this huge new project.
It's interesting, isn't it? The way that we can get on these treadmills that just keep running faster and faster. So people keep pressing the speed button to keep the band going faster.
Yeah.
And that's our mode. That's our mode of working and operating, thinking. And so, you know, sabbatical is next thing on the list, tick. And what do we need to do to progress and advance? And that just stopping and thinking, I mean, even just sort of the stopping and thinking, because I'm sure you put, well, clearly you did put a lot of thought into the proposal.
Yes.
But it was that intellectual thought in from the treadmill, wasn't it? From the sounds of it, in the
and
doing more, gathering more.
Yeah. And it was kind of the, how can I put together the strongest proposal? And also, what can I do that really will benefit or make a contribution to the institution that I'm asking to partner with, right? Because part of the goal of this grant, it's a, you know, in the US, we don't have a lot of diplomacy right now. We're not focused on that. But the idea is that you are building these cross-cultural connections. So I was thinking about my career, but it was also a very engaged project where I was trying to think of, what are the ways that if I'm here in Tanzania being hosted by an institution that I can be most useful and beneficial in some way and not just be, you know, a drag on their system or be doing something that's totally irrelevant to their departmental or institutional goals.
And yet when you also talk about just being worn out and burnt out, you know, there's the question of, when you get to stand back and look, how much use can you be from that position? Like, what resources have you got left to bring?
Exactly. And I had very few. I mean, I had, at that time, I was not reading much about burnout, but since I've, you know, been reading more about burnout, and I think the way that cynicism takes over, the way that you doubt, I mean, I was sitting there saying, well, I got tenure, so I have a job for life. I've been validated by peers. And I felt at that time like I wanted to quit my job, which just doesn't make any sense, because I felt this, there's this very existential feeling like, does any of this really matter? Like, am I making an impact? If I'm just publishing journal articles, is that actually doing anything to improve the world or education, right? And since I work in an applied field, I feel like, you know, the reason I do research is because I want to make things a little better if I can for teachers and kids and families. Yeah. And so as I look back now, I realize that sort of disengagement or just kind of, right, unfounded resentment toward maybe students who weren't doing anything wrong. It was just my own frustration and having no energy or resources left. And that was driving that cynicism and resentment.
Do you think this is a common thing post-tenure? Because it feels like, especially in the US system, where tenure, in some other countries, institutions, there is that sort of equivalent of the tenure review process, you know, promotion to the next step. But it's more a checkpoint for everyone and a nice sort of validation point rather than there are only X positions and, you know, X plus Y people applying for these positions. And so it feels like, especially in the US, there's much more pressure on that tenure process.
I think so. I think, you know, I have a good friend who was a faculty member in Australia and then Scotland. And what I learned from his process is that the US system is very high stakes, I think, for tenure. So if you get denied tenure, then you have one more year at your institution and then you have to leave. You can't try again.
Yeah.
So I do think there's a lot of pressure. And then the other thing that happens, and, you know, I really like my job. And so this is not to throw shade at my institution or department, but when I was going up for tenure, the expectations were not very clear. And it just felt like, you know, I think some institutions will say you need this many articles in these types of journals, or and so you know what you're aiming for. To me, going up for tenure felt like you just had to do more and more. And I think some people are in this situation where no one will kind of tell them when they've met the bar. And so then it does put you in this position of feeling very unsure whether you've ever kind of done what you're supposed to do. Yeah. And the cynic in me feels like sort of the neoliberal university maybe likes that a little bit.
Happy
for it makes you more productive, you know, if you're constantly striving. So I do, you know, the more people I meet now through my work, I think it is very common for people to just feel very burnt out. And honestly, particularly women and women who are starting families early in their career, I think there is a lot to balance and this constant weight of, you know, well, I need to get another publication out, or I have to go to this conference in order to build my network so that my external reviewers will be able to write good things about me, you know. And there's always this like, you need to network and get to know people, but people can't know you that well because then they can't write for you for your review. So yeah, just a lot of gray space and a lot of striving, I think.
And what other ways did that sense of sort of burnout, worn out play out for you? You talked about the students just being too much or just wondering what you were doing, having impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think I really slowed down on my research. I was really not very interested in working on my research. I think after I got tenure, I mean, the nice thing was that I felt like I could finally breathe. And so I think I took that next year. Different institutions do it differently. We had to, once you get tenure, you can't go on sabbatical right away. So I had a year where I went back and I was teaching and doing my regular work. You apply that fall for sabbatical, but then you don't start your sabbatical until the following academic year. And so in some ways that is really nice, because I think I went back and I just, every time I had that feeling of, I have to do this, I could stop and say, but do I have to? Why do I have to? Is this a real expectation, or is this an expectation that I've put on myself? And most of those were expectations I put on myself, because at that point, if I already had tenure, I mean, I knew that I wanted to continue my research. I knew that I wanted to continue publishing, but there was no urgency.
Yeah.
And so I think I spent that year, I think because I was so burned out and exhausted, I spent that year kind of stepping back a little bit and really easing up on the pace that I had been working at.
Yeah. And that's definitely a theme I've heard from people I've talked to for the podcast series over the years, getting through tenure and just that time afterwards. And it sounds like it's such an important time, as you said, to breathe, just to breathe. Yeah. And to just reconnect with a longer term perspective about what are you doing and why.
Yeah. And also to give my family a break. You know, I think sometimes we underestimate the amount of, or the ripple effect that our own stress has on our family. And I know for me, it's very real because my husband will always say, well, you're grumpy and the kids are grumpy. And I'm like, that's not fair. Why does everyone have to peg their emotions to mine? They need to choose someone else to, you know, to tether to. But, you know, so it is. And so I think, you know, it really, when you have an ecosystem of people that you're a part of, it's not just my tenure process. I mean, we had all been working very hard to support me through this process. And so it also became an opportunity to say, okay, let's kind of slow down the pace and also think about, you know, my husband who's followed me to Michigan for my job and is now figuring out his own career. Maybe the focus doesn't need to be on me. Maybe we can shift the focus. And part of that for me means, you know, traveling a little less or saying, do I have to go to that conference or can I be here so that the caregiving, you know, the solo parenting is not always falling to him? Or what is he, maybe does he need longer days? And so I can be with the kids a little more, that sort of thing.
I think we're starting to get more discussion and awareness about how we're not superhero solo researchers off on our grand quest, but we're part of an ecosystem and we build on the work of others and, you know, collaborate with others. And I don't often hear families getting included in that discussion of the ecosystem. And that's a lovely reminder that we are multiply connected and anything we do is achieved, you know, in the context of all of these different relationships with the different costs that are entailed.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, the perspective that we've taken in my family is that this, having these moments where, you know, I go to Tanzania for a week or two for field work, those provide nice opportunities for the kids and my husband to have a different kind of relationship, right? And so we've created a family life that does not depend on me being present. And it shouldn't, because they're his children too. He should be able to take care of them. But I think sometimes, you know, things default so much to mom in these situations. Yeah. And I'm fortunate that my husband has been very supportive of, you know, understanding that my work involves this travel and he's encouraging of it. Because I know when he goes away, I'm like, when are you coming back? This is hard to do on my own. But he's always very gracious about it. But yeah, and I think like the kid, you know, my son, I always joke that he's now he's like my business advisor because he asks me questions about my sabbatical coaching business. But before that, you know, he's very curious about the methodology I use and kind of what I'm doing. And so I try to include them in those conversations so they understand, you know, when I'm traveling, it's not because I want to get away from you guys, but here's the goal of that trip. And for me and with Tanzania, it's really about research, but it's also about building relationships over time. And so I want to keep going back to say, I'm here with you, I'm learning with you, and I'm not just someone who's kind of popping in, collecting my data, and then leaving. So being there regularly is very important to me.
Yeah. So what did you end up deciding to do with that sabbatical then?
Oh, yeah. We really left the audience with a cliffhanger there. So
your Fulbright application's in, click, smile on the face, then a pit in the stomach. And
yes, exactly. And I had also been coming up with ideas like, if I don't get the Fulbright, how can I go to Tanzania anyway, right? And researching schools and apartments. So the whole thing was underway. The other thing that happened is in my department, we have this nice tradition of when folks come back from sabbatical, often during the first faculty meeting of the year, the department meeting, we'll have a sabbatical report where people do a slideshow. And it's really nice because they talk not just about the academic things that they did during sabbatical, but they also show pictures. And, you know, many people have kids, and so they're talking about what they did with their kids. And so it's very nice. Soon after I submitted my Fulbright application, my colleague David gave his sabbatical report presentation, and he had been in Florence for his sabbatical. And I looked at his pictures and I just thought, oh, I kind of want David's sabbatical. I've been planning the sabbatical in Tanzania, where a country that I love to be in. But I just thought his seemed so magical, and I hadn't been to Europe in a long time. And I thought, I just imagined myself like walking down cobblestone streets and looking at beautiful architecture. And like you said before, like there was something inside me that thought, I felt calm thinking about that version of sabbatical, a calmness that I didn't feel when I thought about my sabbatical that I was planning. And so I remember I said to after that meeting, said to one of my good friends, like, I think I want David's sabbatical. And I was joking, but not really, because then I started thinking differently about my sabbatical. I started asking myself different questions. So before this moment, before the sort of turning point, I thought sabbatical is about the next professional step, right? It's about positioning myself for the next part of my career. It's doing something meaningful. And it is, right? Like there is an accountability. Sabbatical is not just a vacation. You have to show that you're doing something to, you know, advance your career, benefit the institution, that sort of thing. But I started asking questions like, what if sabbatical was about having an adventure as a family or reconnecting as a family? What if sabbatical was about my husband's career and not mine? What would be useful for him? I've been pulling him along to lots of different things. What if my sabbatical was about rest and overcoming burnout and not, right? Surprise, that didn't cross my mind until about 5 months into thinking about it. And as I asked myself those questions, I really just all these new possibilities for sabbatical came into my mind. And I decided to build my sabbatical not about the next, you know, not around the next logical professional thing, but around me overcoming burnout, reconnecting with my work, reconnecting, like having some fun with my family, because I felt like the past 4 years had just been really stressful for all of us. Maybe 3 years at that point. I feel like COVID has just created this blur in my mind where I can't keep track of time anymore. And what if it were about finishing projects instead of starting new ones? So I thought, going to Tanzania is lovely for all the reasons that I had described to you. But the other thing is that being in Tanzania requires me to always be engaging and being in relationship with people and starting something new. And I just started thinking that what I actually needed was some time where I wasn't building lots of relationships and starting something new. I needed time that was a little more quiet, where I could read, think deeply about the projects that I had started and evaluate whether I still wanted to continue them. And then to just analyze some data and do some writing, because that's the part of my job that I really like the most. And so I wanted to create space for myself to kind of get back into those scholarly activities that really make me feel connected and like I'm doing something meaningful. So that is a long way of that.
And that of explaining. You had said that part of the burnout was just feeling like getting back into the research again was, So it's a lovely shift in perspective. I just have this picture in my head of this busy, 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 and then the going and giving and building new relationships and collecting more data is the busy academic mind. And I loved the what if questions, just allowing yourself the space to, I mean, that's even just stopping. Stopping and asking what if is a stop. What mm-hmm. if it could be different? And that the point that you came to was this isn't about giving out and collecting more. It's about taking in and reconnecting to yourself and other things that are important or that you love doing.
Yeah, it was really about restoration.
Yeah.
And at that point, it became very exciting. So I mean, things might have spiraled a little bit. My husband said it was a little, I don't think it was stressful, but I think it was amusing to him because for the next 2 or 3 months, I have serious wanderlust. And so for the next 2 or 3 months, I would be like, what if we went to Costa Rica? What if we went to Portugal? What if we went to Spain? And so I just had so many ideas. I was researching all these different possibilities, and we eventually settled on Bordeaux, France, as our sabbatical destination. And it was a little bit pragmatic. One of the criteria I had in my mind was somewhere that was a little bit warmer than where we live here in the mm-hmm. frozen tundra of Michigan. My husband, his preferred temperature, I don't know what it is in Celsius, but would be like 80 or 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So originally I was looking at Spain for those reasons. Mm-hmm. But then in Spain or Portugal, it would have been difficult to get a long-term visa. So we were worried about where we could get a visa. Knowing that I completely abandoned the idea of being attached to a university. Mm. So in Tanzania, I would have been attached to a university. In this new version of sabbatical, I said, let's go somewhere that we want to be as a family and where we can have. And also, I was sort of thinking of my husband's career, and he had wanted to make some connections in Europe. So we kind of landed on Europe, and then it was between Valencia and Bordeaux. And Bordeaux had kind of the right combination. There was a small bilingual school we could send the kids to. It was a place where we could have the lifestyle that we wanted as a family. We live a very suburban life where we drive everywhere, and we just wanted to not have a car, take public transit, eat good food, and be in Europe where we could travel around with the kids and have some reconnect with the part of us, you know, that really enjoys adventure and travel and being in mm-hmm. new places. Mm-hmm. So we spent about 5 or 6 months, so one semester, the fall semester in Bordeaux. And then because my husband, I joke that, you know, he was the weighing us down, or he prevented us from staying a full year. But we came back to Michigan for the second part of my sabbatical because he had to go back to work. But we had this magical sabbatical in Bordeaux, and it did for me what I needed it to do.
And if people could see your face when you talked about that, you just lit up, and I can see you almost reliving some of the memories when you're talking about the magical time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I get the feeling that if you had have done the sabbatical that you first planned, you would have come back even more burned out. How did you come
exactly.
back after this sabbatical?
So the biggest surprise for me was that when we came back to the U.S., we came back right before Christmas. And then in about January, I actually wanted to pick up my work. I felt a desire to reengage. And I should say that I did no work while we were in Bordeaux. And it felt like a risk because I really worried, if I stop working, will I ever want to start again? And the answer was yes, because I let myself rest. I walked around Bordeaux. I had coffee with friends. You know, I made friends and we would go out for lunch. We cooked more. We took day trips. I did a lot of jigsaw puzzles, which is something I really enjoy. And I ran a lot. I really wanted to get back into running. And so I also trained for a half marathon. And so I did one in Nice, actually, in November. I think I tried to get into the Bordeaux one, but it fills up very quickly.
Because yes. I believe they stop for wine tastings en route. Is that people aren't so yes. concerned about their times.
Yes. Yeah, there is one that goes through the, I think, the Medoc wine region. Yes. Sounds like a lot of fun. I don't know if I could do it. drinking wine. I mean, there's one like in Wisconsin. I went to grad school in Madison, Wisconsin. And so Wisconsin is a big beer state, I guess. And so at the end of the marathon, as I think is, or the half marathon, as I think is normal, there's always beer at the end. And I just think, like, that's the last thing I want after I'm done running. But anyway, so it was, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we weren't doing anything terribly exciting. The kids were going to school, but it was just like, Bordeaux is a beautiful city. We drank good wine. We ate croissants. When we've gone back, now we stock up on butter. We bring it back because you just can't get butter like that in the U.S. But it was the time that I needed. And then when we came back, I mean, in the spring semester, I was excited to get back into work. But I didn't get back on that treadmill. I was not working at like full time at the pace that I was before sabbatical.
So you talked about it being a restoration and it sounds like a reset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it changed the way I see my career, I think. So one of the things that was very interesting about being in France was that no one cared what I did about my profession, right? We live in a university town where we know a lot of professors. And I think the U.S. is just a little bit more like the first question people ask is, what do you do? And we talk about work a lot. And in France, you know, I think people were curious about how we were able to just live in Bordeaux for 5 months. But after I'd say, I have an année sabbatique, they'd say, oh, okay. And then no one cared. No one wanted to know my resume, right, or my CV. And I think something I discovered was that I can be an interesting person who makes friends and enjoys their life without having my career as the foreground. And it was hard because for me, talking about work is easy. So then thinking about what else do I like to talk about or do? But I think for me, that really shifted my perspective on my career and who I am in relation to my career. And so it's something that I continue to work on is kind of being less attached to my scholarly identity, remembering that I have a lot of other things that I value and other things that are important that I want to prioritize.
I love that question, who am I in relation to my career? And how do you keep reminding yourself to reflect on that? Because once you get back into the system, I imagine it's easy to get pulled back into I am my career.
I think one of the ways is the boundaries that I set were asking myself the question of, is this something that I have to do, actually have to do, or is it something that I'm telling myself I have to do? And so an example is a colleague and I, we have a grant right now to do some work in Tanzania, and we were kind of looking ahead to the next grant, and we had to make a decision this fall. The call for proposals came out. It was going to be a very quick turnaround, and old Bethany would have said, okay, like, come on, let's do it. And I would have, that would have taken over a month of my life, and I would have been very stressed out and working long hours on this. And instead I said, okay, well, we currently have a grant. It doesn't end until the end of June. We're going to have writing to do after that. Do we actually need to spend the time right now applying for a new grant? Is that the best use of our time? And the answer was, we didn't have to. No one was telling us we had to. And in fact, right now is a challenging time to apply for a grant because so much funding has been cut in the U.S. that these foundations are being flooded with applicants. And I thought about, is that what I want my life to look like in the next month? And no, it's not. So, you know, that funding will probably be there. And if it's not, that's okay.
And funding somewhere.
There'll be. Right. So I think it's hard because unlearning that muscle memory of just you always have to go for the next thing is very hard. But I think I've also, I'm just able to maybe slow down a little bit. And I don't always get it right. I make mistakes and then I have to undo it. But giving myself time to pause. I have a colleague who said she never, when someone asks her if she wants to take on a new project, she always waits 24 hours before responding. And so I've tried to do something like that where, again, I think this is a very gendered thing where I'm a people pleaser, but I think I have this, I want to make you happy, so I will say yes. And just saying, I'm going to need to think about that, or I'm going to need to look at my schedule and see if I have time for that, helps me to not just take on more and more and more because I feel like I need to.
Yeah. And also you said early in the conversation about this being applied work and work that you really care about and the impact that you want to have through the work. So it's also that thing of also wanting to have that impact. And that's just such a wise thing to do, just to gain that pause and that space, just to create the time to reflect and really think about. And it's reminding me of a question that I often ask myself. Sometimes I have a post-it hanging on my thing about, if I say yes to this, what am I saying no to?
Yes.
And you've just articulated that whole trade-off that is entailed in any of these decisions, because you could. And that's one of the problems with academia, isn't it? There's no stopping point. You can always have another grant and put in the month or more to write it.
Yeah.
And then you get it, you got to deliver on it.
And it's a lot easier to start things and work on new ideas than to finish them. And so I think the other thing that I've realized is that I am able to follow through and publish things. But if you're constantly in this cycle of starting something new, then you don't give yourself time to really think about what you want to write about it. And that's where we have the impact. It's not in collecting the data. So I think there's a book that I'd read, or I think I skimmed, because it's fairly obvious, but I think it has a good important message. It's called Essentialism. And I think the image on the is kind of this circle with, I don't know, 8 arrows emanating from it, going in all different directions. And the main idea of the book is that if you are putting energy into so many different little things, you don't make an impact on any of them. And if you streamline and you choose a few things to focus on, then you can make your highest contribution to the things that you are working on. And so I try to think about that too. Where do I want to make my highest contribution?
Yeah. And that's something that the egg collecting in academia of how many grants and how many papers and the targets, the performance metrics, we lose focus on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's countercultural to say, I'm actually going to try to do less, but do it better. Because I'll be more focused. Yeah.
And the finishing is such a good point as well, because again, I think that's something that I reflect back on. There are many things that we did the work on, we collected the data on, and never finished in the wrapping up. You talked about the time and space to reflect and draw out the insights and that from the work. And you come from an education background, and you also talked about unlearning. In what ways do you think your disciplinary background influences your thinking around these issues around unlearning and the importance of reflecting and thinking?
Yeah, that's a great question that I haven't thought about. But I think, you know, in education, we talk about the explicit curriculum and then the hidden curriculum. Mm-hmm. So in any classroom, there is, of course, kids are learning algebra or geometry or whatever. But then there's also a hidden curriculum in the way that kids are being socialized or the kinds of implicit signals that they're getting about how to act in a classroom or the kinds of things that will get positive attention from a teacher. And so I think I have been thinking more about this, partly because I'm teaching a research methods class in the spring, and I think we're going to do kind of a class research project about the hidden curriculum of being a graduate student, you know, the things people tell you and the things that they don't tell you. just as a way of learning how to do interviews and observations.
Meta project.
Yeah, I thought it would be meaningful to the students, and it's not in anyone's research area, I don't think. So I think part of what I'm trying to do is unlearn the hidden curriculum, maybe, or maybe just also have more agency in the process to not just be caught up in the wave of, well, this is what the academy wants me to do. And to sort of resist the expectation that you'll just give more and more of yourself for, quite frankly, not more compensation. I got asked over the summer, I was getting emails from a unit on campus asking me to be part of meetings about some new initiative. And I thought initially, this is kind of interesting. But then I realized I wasn't really clear about what they were asking of me. And so I asked the question that I think you're not really supposed to ask is, like, how do you imagine that being part of this work is going to benefit faculty? They said, well, you know, if you have a research interest in X, it might be. And I just said, well, thanks. That's really clarifying. Actually, I don't prefer to be part of these conversations because, again, it would have taken me away from the things that I care about. And so I could have spent, you know, these hour-long brainstorming meetings. And I think it's important work, but it's not work for me to do. And it can feel very flattering. I think ego is part of it too, right? It feels flattering to be asked to be part of something or to write something. I think some people are surprised when they ask me, oh, would you write a chapter about this for this edited volume? And I say, well, that's not actually my research interest. So no, I'm not able to. And people have a hard time hearing that. People have a hard time hearing you say, no, I'm not, you know, well, but it's going to be so prestigious. Well, that's lovely, but it's actually not. I don't want to spend 6 months or a year of my life working on this. Not because it's not important. It's just not what I'm focused on.
Not important. It's not your important.
Yeah. And it's easy to get, I think, pulled into things because it feels flattering to be asked to be on a committee or to make a contribution to something. But like you said, every time you say yes to something, you're saying no to other things. And so I think that's the other way that I try to keep things in check is saying, like, do I actually, if I say yes to this, what is my life going to look like in 2 or 3 months? And what am I not able to do, either professionally or personally? Because I'm just not interested in being a person who is working frenetically all the time. When my son was very young, my husband and I decided we basically would not work on the weekends. And so I told myself, if the work that I'm able to do and still be present with my family can get me tenure, then that's great. And if it doesn't, then I'm sure I have other marketable skills that I could use in a different industry.
Yeah, and that's something we do need to remind all of ourselves and our students and our colleagues about, that we can get obsessed with this one gold standard supposed career path, and there are many ways that we can apply our skills. So a lot of your personal journey, it seems, post-tenure has been about finding your own identity and what's important to you and finding your agency in making the choices, in saying yes or no, in asking the what if questions. I'm just curious, do you have any like reflective journaling practice or anything like that to help you in this, or is this just something that sort of mulls in your head?
Yeah, I wish I could say that I had a journaling practice, but no, I think it's just something that happens in my head. And then I have a great friend and mentor. I just spent a couple hours with her the other day, and she's a great person for me to kind of say, this is what's happening, these are the choices that I'm making, or this is coming up and it's friction. Yeah. And she's very helpful in, you know, she'll call me out if I'm just being selfish or unreasonable, but in saying, like, it's okay to make decisions that that meet your needs and to not get pulled into other people's expectations or do things just because other people want you to do them.
Yeah, that's lovely. Just having that sort of support and colleague that you can trust to do that.
Yeah, because so many people will, I think, encourage you to just keep going. It's well-meaning, right? But yeah. I think people will say, well, the strategic thing would be to do this. And so someone who kind of help will validate the idea that I don't need to be doing everything. But I think the more, I think I do reflect on it, but also the more I practice it, the more I stop and think about things and then make a decision that's grounded in sort of my own values or how I want to spend my time, I think yeah. it becomes easier. And it's a little easier to then see the things where, you know, or to see colleagues who are kind of like unnecessarily wrapping themselves up in the department politics or taking on more and more things mm-hmm. that they don't need to take on.
Yeah. And in the process, you're gathering more evidence to confirm that it all still works.
Exactly. And something that I ask my clients a lot, because when we're working on a sabbatical plan, a big part of that is thinking about boundaries. And so how you make this great plan, now how do you protect your time? Because again, it's well-meaning people, but students are going to keep needing things from you. Collaborators will keep needing things. So how do you put those guardrails in place so that your time is protected? And people will say, well, I'm worried that if I stop reviewing grants for this organization, you know, X or Y might happen. Or if I step away from this, X or Y. And so I usually ask, like, what's the worst thing that could happen? Mm. And usually it's nothing actually bad. Yeah. You know, the things we imagine, even if the worst case scenario happened, it's probably not that bad. And I've had this experience. I've talked to enough colleagues and clients now who have said, you know, I said no to a lot of things during my sabbatical. And guess what?
Guess what?
You come back and people still ask you to do things, you know, and they ask you to do more. So that's why, in my experience, it's so important to have good boundaries during sabbatical, because once you come back, you get flooded with requests for doing things.
So I want to come back to the boundaries, because that was going to be one of the questions that I had about creating the space, but still having the responsibilities for students and labs and projects, among other things. But just stepping back, what's one of the first things you get people to think about when they're thinking about their own sabbaticals?
Yeah, so we start in a place that I think is counterintuitive.
And sadly, that's where we'll leave it for now. If you're curious about what is the counterintuitive place to start when you're thinking about your sabbaticals, keep an eye out for part two that will be released as the next episode. Part two will provide lots of practical guidance for you about being more intentional about designing not just your leave, but also, I think, your career and a career that is sustainable and meaningful in the long term.
You can find the summary notes, a transcript, and related links for this podcast on www.changingacademiclife.com. You can also subscribe to Changing Academic Life on iTunes, Spotify, and I'm really hoping that we can widen the conversation about how we can do academia differently. And you can contribute to this by rating the podcast and also giving feedback. And if something connected with you, please consider sharing this podcast with your colleagues. Together, we can make change happen.